Mankind has got the claw locked in.
Somebody's got to do something, Mr. McMahon. Somebody's got to... He's got him!
Look at this now. The claw on. Rock desperately trying to get to the ropes. Can he do it?
Reach back!
Can
reach
the corporate
ropes.
Champion get to the ropes? Wait a minute! It's over! We have a new champion! We have a new WWF champion!
No way!
Mankind have made it! The Rock! Mankind! He's fulfilled his dream! Mick Foley can call himself champion!
This cannot be happening!
Wait a minute.
For a moment.
Wait a second. What's Mr. McMahon doing?
Cut the damn music!
Okay, all right. All right, Mankind wins the match. Mankind wins the match.
We have a new champion.
However, the only way to become a WWF champion is by pinfall or submission. And since The Rock did not tap out or did not say I quit, still your WWF champion, ladies and gentlemen, The Rock.
Oh, that's a damn shame.
The Rock says, The Rock says, The Rock says, The Rock says, The Rock says.
Welcome to Review Away, everyone. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting with a post-Christmas edition of Review Away. And Mr. Ting, I got to celebrate Christmas with you on Sunday.
Yes, and with all of you as well. I had a lot of fun on the wall.
It was a lot. We got way more calls than I anticipated, and I based that solely on you and your drawing power.
Well, there weren't too many calls. I mean, I guess the quality of calls is what's important, and we had some pretty high-quality calls.
Some big guests. We had waiting.
Yeah.
And predictions.
Some huge surprises.
Yeah, I can't believe some people would assume those champions would be in place a year from now.
I can't believe that one guy who called from that place in
the U.S.
I couldn't believe what he said. And I know, like, you're just like,
you should download the law right now to see what we're talking about. It's right around the 1 hour 20 mark,
so somewhere around there, or give or take, like, you know, an hour or so.
But today, Wei, we're going to have a horrible show because we're hitting rock bottom today.
Yes. Yes, we are.
Now, my first thing is an apology for picking this show.
Why did you pick this show?
I don't know. It was December, and, well, actually, what we're going to review next week, I legitimately want to go back and watch because it's a show that I remember fondly from when I was much younger. And this pay-per-view kind of leads into that. But this pay-per-view, I had never seen it before this week.
Okay.
And it sucked. You watched this in one sitting. It took me four.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, before I watched it, you were already apologizing. You're like, Wei, I'm sorry.
And I never do that because usually it's, well, give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know how someone could watch this. It felt like it was 8 hours.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say this is terrible. It's definitely far from the worst show I've ever seen. I think
boring might be a better term.
The thing is, it was just a pay-per-view that you didn't have to watch. It was a pay-per-view that, you know, where not too much of nothing eventful really happens.
And this is right during the Attitude Era when people kind of fondly remember that from March of 98 till April of 2001, there was nothing bad in the WWF. Everything was perfect. Mm-hmm. Every character was over. Every show was sold out.
Why can't we go back to those times when wrestling was so great?
Well, that's the problem. When you go back, you realize it wasn't always great. No. And sometimes you had a lot of stupid shit, and you had some terrible wrestling as well at times.
Yeah.
So rock bottom from Vancouver, British Columbia, a pay-per-view in Canada. This was their first pay-per-view in Canada since the infamous Survivor Series of 97.
Is that right?
Yep, just over a year afterwards. This took place Sunday, December the 13th, 1998, at GM Place in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
We were mere ninth graders at this point. Minor Niners.
That's correct.
We were referred to.
We just started high school.
Did you go? You went to a public high school, didn't you?
Yeah.
So did you start? Did you have like junior high and then high school?
Actually, my elementary school went all the way up to grade 8. So.
Okay, so it was the same as mine. Then you did 5 years of high school.
Yeah.
Okay, so we had the same. So you were at a new school in grade 9.
By the way, we did 5 years of high school not because we failed a class.
No.
That was just the Ontario system up until that time. OAC, a complete waste of time.
Yeah, it really was when you think about it.
Yeah, come on. We're on the same level as, you know.
OAC was my favorite year of high school.
Oh, mine too.
Because I didn't need a full schedule to pass, so I got a spare each semester.
Yep.
The first semester, I had fourth period spare, and I had lunch A, meaning that I finished school every day at 12:15 and then had the rest of the afternoon and night to do whatever I wanted. And then in second semester, I had first period spare, meaning I didn't start school till like 10 in the morning.
Man, you lucked out. You really did. Because I would often have a – maybe I would have a spare, but I would have a class at the end of the day. So I would just have this huge gap where I would have nothing to do, but I couldn't go home because I had to go to my last class.
Well, I loved having a fourth period spare so much that when I had to have this class in second semester, I had philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to my teacher and I said, listen, I'm on the yearbook team. And it was like a group of like three of us doing this yearbook. And I told him, listen, we need time to finish this yearbook. So if I'm not here in class, obviously I'm working on the yearbook. And he told me, John, what you're doing is a huge value to the school and to school spirit. You will be marked present every single day.
Are you kidding me? Wow.
Regardless of whether you're here or not.
Well,
and, dude, I got a 99 in that class.
You got a 99?
Oh, it was ridiculous. Dude, it was like...
That's amazing. I don't think I've ever gotten 99.
Dude, it's philosophy. It was just like anything I wrote, I could justify. It was like bullshitting, essentially. It was like trolling, but a course.
Yes. And, I guess in your whole life, even at a young age, you've had great success with convincing people of certain things and getting your way.
Yeah, but my teacher, he didn't come back and say, I'll mark you present for half the classes. He made me present for all of the classes.
He gave you 99%. He didn't give you 50.
I've kind of fallen from my peak. Yeah, but OAC, a great, great semester.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we graduated, and then we went to Ryerson, where for a full year, me and Wei probably attended a few classes together and never once met. Whole year.
No. I probably had like a history through film class with you. But
you were in history through film?
Yeah, I was in that.
Was Diana in that class?
Yeah, I was in that class.
Holy fuck, we were in that class together?
Yeah, we were in that class, yeah.
Holy shit. That exam was on a Saturday fucking morning, I remember.
I don't remember the exam.
It was the day they caught Saddam Hussein.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
And I thought that was when John Cena had that promo.
No, that was Osama.
Ah.
Different terrorist.
That's right, okay.
Wow. I had no clue we had that class together.
Yeah, I was in that class. But yeah, we'd never met. And
imagine you never said that or overheard me talking about the law. What would have happened to our lives? They would have gone in such different directions.
That's true. Although I think I would have still applied to work at the Fight Network and we might have met that way.
So fate was destiny, actually.
This sounds very,
very
weird.
Let's move on to rock bottom. From GM Place.
Oh, God.
I watched this on a home video.
Well, how did you get the home video if you never saw this?
I remember before? My brother bought this on VHS years and years ago, and this was in my my storage unit.
But you never popped the tape in?
Nope.
You just
never had
it.
The desire. I looked at the back of it and read the matches. I was like, I never need to sit back and watch this. Yeah. I never now, ever, ever, ever am bored and say, oh, why don't I pop in a wrestling tape? I don't ever do that.
No, I would say for you and I, our wrestling quota is quite full.
If there's anything extra I watch, it's if WWE sends us a DVD with a documentary on it.
Yeah, something
I'll watch that.
Yes, yes, yes.
But there is no pleasure watching ever.
Oh, boy. Boy, do we sound depressed and jaded.
No, I'm not... I'm not trying to complain about it, but I just... I am above my quota of what I can watch in a week, wrestling-wise. Yeah. It's just, I want to watch something on television that doesn't require promos and matches
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
questioning of booking.
Well, let's think about it. How can we freshen these up? I mean, you know, what can we do to make our viewing experiences somewhat different without the use of alcohol? Or maybe with the use of alcohol.
Maybe we should call up cable companies and give them reviews to pay-per-views every month. Tell them what we thought of it.
Okay.
And what we feel is a justifiable price for this pay-per-view.
And what we feel we...
I paid $55.95, and this isn't worth a dollar over 20.
And this is how much I want you to pay me back.
Yes. Like a rebate system.
That's great.
That could bring back fans.
I think that's a great idea, but not really. Okay, let's get to the show. By the way, this was a pay-per-view immediately following Survivor Series 1998.
Featuring the biggest double cross in WWF history, according to Michael Cole.
According to Michael Cole on this pay-per-view.
After the 98 Survivor Series.
The 98 Survivor Series, which was a recreation in kayfabe terms of the 97 Screwjob. Featuring The Rock and Mankind in a match where The Rock turned heel via... Vince McMahon calling for
the bell
after putting Mankind into
the St. Louis screw job.
The St. Louis screw job, yes, after The Rock put Mankind into a sharpshooter. So.
Which is an event we have reviewed in the past that you can go into our archives. You can go to fightnetwork.com/podcasts.
I try to imagine what it would be like for a new listener to go back and listen to all of our reviews in the order of the events. And hearing us talk about just random conversations jumping from parts of our lives.
I was thinking about that. Not exactly, but just in terms of that we've done all these reviews that it's almost like putting a puzzle together where it's like 98 now. We've reviewed probably 3 or 4 of the 12 pay-per-views there. Mm-hmm. And it's like, yeah, at some point you could probably listen to a year of WWF shows that we have recorded over the span of years.
Yes, and it would be the oddest thing for me to listen to, I imagine. Yeah.
When we get to we do at least review them like in order, like this Rock Bottom show we are recording here in December and was a December show.
Yeah.
So if we were to talk about Christmas on this show, it's not completely lost on people.
Well, I guess
it's like you're going through the seasons.
But I imagine, could you imagine like maybe like 5 years down the road if we are still continuing to do this podcast, maybe perhaps either you or I will have children and then we'll be talking about our kids and then the next one people listen to will be like...
I don't let my kid listen to this.
You only let him watch the pay-per-views.
Yeah. Depending on who's on the show.
Gotcha.
I have a kid, I would totally put him on the podcast. I'd make him co-host for a week or something.
And you would probably get award for worst father of the year.
I'd let him review Impact.
You would use your son.
Yeah. He could explain to me the knockout division to me. Okay, so the show starts off... I don't know if all of this is included on what you watched, Way.
I had the home video version. By the way, thank you to a listener of ours who graciously uploaded... I won't name names just because it's not... Never mind.
We don't want to raise his ire.
Okay. There you go.
Let's land back here on our notes. Mm-hmm. And it starts off... That was a horrible joke. The WWF home video exclusive... Featuring a creepy voiceover from Michael Hayes discussing the Buried Alive match.
Was this Michael Hayes? Are you sure?
Almost 99% sure it was Michael Hayes.
Are you sure it wasn't Blassie?
No, it went into another video afterwards with Blassie.
Oh, never mind. Okay.
Yeah, that one was definitely Blassie. He has a very distinguishable voice. But then they show... Did you see this? The Rock appearing at Planet Hollywood in Vancouver?
Yes, I did.
So he shows up with the WWF title. He welcomes everyone to his pay-per-view. Says, from now on, In Your House will be called In the Rock's House. And he said, from now on, he's going to be, hosting here at Planet Hollywood. No. And got a total babyface reaction.
Sure. Well, this was The Rock, of course, in his corporation, phase. And this is The Rock with his long sideburns and... even today, you probably once in a while see people do their Rock impressions, and whenever they do, it really is a recreation, I find, of this version of The Rock, this 1998 form of The Rock, where all his catchphrases were just starting to catch on, and the eyebrow and everything. This was like Rock in his, I guess, purest, most stereotypical form.
Then the other opening video airs, this one with Freddie Blassie over shots of a cemetery, because tonight a man will die on pay-per-view.
Yes, for sure.
This was more barbaric than UFC at the time.
Burying somebody alive?
Yeah. One man enters, or two men enter, okay. One man leaves.
Yes. There's going to be a buried alive match on this show between The Undertaker and Stone Cold Steve Austin. What was the context of that feud going into this?
The booking had been so bad that they felt a metaphor was necessary. I don't... as much as I pride myself on memory, there was a lot on this show that, like, I had no idea what the lead-up was.
The only thing that stood out to me was the shot of the crucifixion of Steve Austin. That's the one that everybody probably remembers.
Yes. The symbol.
The symbol. Never mind.
The big debate.
Yeah.
And this was awesome. The show starts off, and it's Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler, because if you remember at this time, while they were over in England for a pay-per-view, Jim Ross's mother passed away, and this led to Ross having a reoccurrence of Bell's palsy and was taken off of television. And this was, I think he was on the Raw leading into this, and it was on this pay-per-view that Michael Cole replaced Ross. And so it was Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler. Almost a thread to today's product.
Yes, but in very, very different roles for both men.
And Michael Cole opens the show by saying, quote, "We have hit rock bottom."
Yeah, yeah, that's what he said. The entrance for the pay-per-view features, well, you know, the entrance and two gigantic, 10-story tall Rock posters. Two posters of The Rock.
It's his pay-per-view.
It's his pay-per-view, yeah. I thought this was cool. I like it when the set actually plays into storyline. I think it's something funny.
Imagine we got a like a Mark Henry pay-per-view.
A giant Mark Henry poster?
Yeah.
Okay.
Kicking Rocks.
Yes. Kicking Rocks.
This was definitely at a time when The Rock was, you know, they had teased him as the babyface, and I thought it was clicking before they turned him heel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think was still in that process of really trying to get him over as the top heel in the company. And this pay-per-view was completely designed to present him as this huge star. From there, they mentioned the Rock match with Mankind, where for some reason there was a stipulation here where if Rock was injured and could not wrestle tonight, he would forfeit the title.
Yeah,
this would be a show-long storyline.
I didn't exactly... understand that either, but I'm guessing on the Raw beforehand, Foley attacked The Rock or something, and yeah, the stipulation in their contract said that if The Rock couldn't compete in this match, Foley would be awarded the title, and that was the tease running throughout the whole pay-per-view.
But what was weird was that they never presented Rock as having an injury or even teasing he wouldn't be able to wrestle.
Well, that's right, because you saw The Rock just appear at Planet Hollywood about to host the show in all his glory, not really suffering, you know, hurting or anything like that. So a little inconsistent, I found.
This was also back in the days of Sunday Night Heat, and I just wanted to read over some of the results from Sunday Night Heat leading into this show. We had Gilbert retain his light heavyweight championship, defeating Matt Hardy in 62 seconds. We had Kevin Quinn, who is a very well-known indie wrestler out of Chicago, defeating Brian Christopher. Triple H defeated Draws in a minute 37. And the New Age Outlaws defeated the Acolytes by disqualification. The longest match went 2:23.
So what was that? What was the New Age Outlaws match? Because they wrestled on this show, too.
I think it was a match booked by Shawn Michaels to weaken them before their title defense on the pay-per-view.
Oh, okay.
So that was Sunday Night Heat leading into Rock Bottom. And we get into things with, well, first of all, there was a sign that read, "HBK is a sellout bitch."
Yeah, clever.
Then we go to our first matchup, and Val Venus comes out, and Finkel announces, at a combined weight of 500 plus pounds, Val Venus.
Huh?
As I assume that he was supposed to come out with The Godfather, or at least that's how he was introduced.
Okay.
And then Venus gets on the microphone and says, he's like butter on a pancake. He melts in the hot spot.
Nice.
And they cut away to crowd shots of women. And then we get The Godfather coming out. And he comes out with his hose, the whores. And he offers the whores to Val for the night. And Val says, I have the Yule log if you have the fireplace.
Uh-huh. Fireplace. Wow.
Fireplaces are big.
And burning, so you would have to assume these women have probably got some type of infection, perhaps.
Yeah. Very dirty.
Yeah. All right.
So we go to...
Man, The Godfather was over. There's so many... They cut the, like, one shot in the audience, and, like, five of the signs in this one shot were for The Godfather.
Everyone loved this guy.
Yeah.
Incredibly over. So we've got Val Venus and Godfather against Mark Henry and D'Lo Brown, who are accompanied by Jacqueline and Terry, who were known at the time as PMS.
Yeah.
Pretty Mean Sisters.
Pretty Mean Sisters. Clever. Another clever one. D'Lo was, of course, wearing his chest protector 8 months following the initial injury. And Henry was in full-on sexual chocolate mode.
And yet didn't get a chance of sexual chocolate when he came to the ring.
No, he didn't. Boy, like, nobody really could have... This is my first Mark Henry match from this era that I've seen since he's had his push as a world champion. And nobody ever thought that this guy would end up being a champion someday.
Or still with the company 13 years after this event.
Yep, that's right.
So... Godfather hits the Ho Train before it was his finish in the corner onto Mark Henry. Henry and D'Lo get Venus into their corner and takes a splash from Mark Henry. D'Lo hits the sky high, but then the Godfather breaks up the count. D'Lo got a lot of the heel heat here from the crowd. They were definitely D'Lo was really over at this time.
He was.
I thought the chest pad gimmick was something everyone connects with D'Lo even to this day.
Mm-hmm.
We got one of the least dramatic hot tags you'll ever see when Venus tagged in Godfather. And then as soon as Godfather gets the hot tag, he hits like a punch and tags back Val Venus. Thanks a lot, partner. Then the hoes and PMS start arguing on the floor. And the referee gets distracted. And Jacqueline runs in and pulls down Val Venus's trunks, revealing a thong. And this leads to Mark Henry splashing Venus. And Mark Henry and D'Lo get the win at 5 minutes and 57 seconds. And his ass just hung out there for minutes on end.
That's right.
What a finish.
Yes. The woman pulls down the man's pants to reveal a thong. Are thongs popular with wrestlers? I feel like this is...
Well, I guess it prevents, theme. Like, you know, bunching and stuff, you know? Like,
I guess so. I remember this happening before. Like, Edge wore a thong or something in a match, didn't he?
Yeah.
And it's like, it's to prevent the...
A lot of them are wearing, like, trunks, which are basically, like, briefs.
Yeah, they're briefs. And it's to prevent, I guess, underwear lining and from showing and whatnot. But
yeah,
it's weird.
Banana hammocks.
Yeah, just to think of these guys wearing thongs. Anyway...
We're off to a great start on this show. Rock bottom, everyone. It's what we're naming this show.
It is the beginning of a new year.
Actually, it's the end of the year.
Yes. What am I saying?
You're getting ahead of yourself.
I am. You know, the other thing I noticed right off the bat with the show is that, man, it's odd hearing Cole actually call a match.
Yeah.
And he actually does really well. I thought he was good on this show.
He was fine to me, but then they showed a highlight package later in the night with Jim Ross. I was like, oh, there's no comparison.
Okay.
Like, it's so far and away, but I will agree. But Cole was never horrendous.
No, I thought he did a fine job on this show.
They do a pre-tape interview with Michael Cole and Rock back in the skybox at the GM place with Mankind attacking Rock. and gets tossed into a wall, and this is where Rock's ribs were injured. So maybe this was the tease that he wouldn't compete, but they didn't really play this up afterwards.
Where did this interview take place?
Was it? They said it was in the Skybox, somewhere in the arena.
Oh, it was
earlier
just
in
today.
Day.
It wasn't even on the Go Home show.
No. This was
a Heat, I'm assuming. Okay. Yeah, it's so odd to me that they would work these angles so late into, like, the day of the show, they work these angles, and I don't know. I you can't invest yourself into it.
And then they show Mankind on Heat cutting a promo saying that if Rock fails to wrestle, the title becomes his based on the contract. And we go to the back, and the doctor tells Rock he shouldn't wrestle, but Rock vows to defend the title even if he's injured. What a heel.
What a heel.
The valiant heel. He's going to overcome this sneak attack.
But, like, from the beginning, this whole Rock heel turn was sort of... It was sort of blurred. I mean, he was still very much over, and I don't know. They weren't trying to build him up as a straight-up heel.
Next match is a tag bout with the Headbangers against Golga and Kurgan, star of Monster Brawl.
Kurgan, yes. And as well as... What else is he in?
Big Sherlock Fish? Holmes.
Or not Big Fish, he wasn't in that. Sherlock Holmes, yes.
Yeah. And Golga and Kurgan were accompanied by Luna and Giant Silva. This is when they comprised the Oddities. Kurgan's gimmick at the time was that... Golga's gimmick was that he has the mind of a 12-year-old who watches South Park, according to Michael Cole.
Yes.
That's our character.
And his favorite... character on South Park is Cartman, as Cole says.
Cartman.
He's a superhero. Cartman.
He flies down shopping aisles.
Yes. That's the gimmick. Gimmick of a man who watches another TV show.
Kurgan left professional wrestling because he just didn't click for him, and he moved on to acting. And I've got to say, that was probably a wise career choice.
Probably.
This man was uncoordinated, which says volumes about the faith they had in Giant Silva, who was only booked to stand in his corner.
Oh, man. Wow.
Not the smoothest of guys here, but they were big and tall.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And one would eventually go into MMA.
That's right. Giant Silva.
Mosh runs into a bear hug and then a side slam by Kurgan. See, a side slam to Thrasher, where Kurgan nearly drops him. Then there was a double splash to the headbangers by Kurgan, follow-up splash by Golga. And basic of basic here, and even that began to be trying here for Kurgan. Golga got a hot tag, no one cared. Hits a drop kick on Mosh, which was like a high spot for Golga, who of course was John Tenta, for those that might not be familiar. And he even teased going for the old earthquake finish here, mm-hmm. where he goes sit on his opponent, but Mosh comes off the top rope with what could have been like a Thez Press-like dive. It looked very odd. I think Cole called it like a crossbody.
Yeah, it looked like a high
whatever.
Cross. Yeah.
Pins Golga, 6:53, not a great match.
No, it was slow, not very good. I didn't think there was much flow and very little audience reaction, which would end up being a running theme.
Yeah, this crowd sucked. This was like an Impact Zone crowd.
They were alive for many.
They got hot for a few things.
Parts.
Yeah, very selective in what they were hot for.
Yeah. Immediately after the match, I don't know if you noticed, John, but Mosh, after winning, goes out of the ring and a fan ringside shoves him.
Oh, I didn't.
And
see
Mosh.
That.
Walks right up to this fan, spits in the fan's face.
Whoa!
Like point blank, just a wad of spit in his face, and the ref has to hold the headbangers back from running across at this fan.
Do you know what he called that?
No.
The Mosh spit.
John Pollock, ladies and gentlemen.
Vince and Shane are with Patterson and Briscoe, and tells Vince that they're going to take care of it. And they offer him coffee, and that's it. They're going to take care of it. There's no context of what it is.
Yeah, I really didn't... I wasn't buying into this whole storyline at all.
What did you think of the production back here in 98? Like, their backstage stuff? I mean, fuck, it's so slick now, and...
No, well, it's pretty standard. What do you mean?
I just thought an overall... Like, the video packages, the music they used. I mean, this was still, I don't want to say regional company, but this was a much smaller company in the mid-90s, and this was their growth year, where it was, everything was not state of the art.
I didn't think there was anything wrong with the backstage segments. In fact, I feel like the backstage segments today are too overproduced.
Too produced?
Yeah, too produced with the lighting in the background. Like, that's all that's unnecessary. The video packages, though, have improved leaps and bounds from this era. They're just amazing right now.
Owen Hart came out next to the biggest reaction, I think, on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Huge babyface reaction. And they recap a video of the legendary Owen Hart Steve Blackman feud involving the Blue Blazer and Blackman dressing up as the Blue Blazer to attack Owen. And it was the reason that Hart came out of retirement following a neck injury to Dan Severn. If you remember this, he injured Dan Severn, said he was going to retire, but then came out of retirement.
Came out of retirement. Well, he showed up as a Blue Blazer, of course, but
yes,
that was never confirmed.
Steve Blackman comes out to not a hero's reaction, and Lawler says, "Down in the States, everyone loves this guy." Liar. So Owen and Steve Blackman, Hart takes him down with shots, and there was no way this crowd was turning. Chance of Owen. Hart got clotheslined in the aisle and then brought back to the ring. Blackman applies a bow and arrow submission, which Michael Cole called a unique maneuver.
Uh-huh.
There was no heat when Blackman was on offense. Owen came back with an enziguri, huge pop, chance of U.S. sucks. Hart goes to the floor, and Blackman hits a baseball slide that nailed Owen to the point that there's no way this guy did not have a concussion from this. His head... I don't know how worse I've ever seen a guy's head hit a mat before than this. Like, you would have to go back to one of, like, Eddie or Benoit's, like, insane power bombs.
Mm.
Like, Owen's head just rang off the floor. This was... I actually, like, yelled shit while I was watching this.
Yeah. Wow.
Nuts. Jerry Lawler was just lost at parts in this match. At one point, this was his saying... He says, in regards to Vancouver, "It rains here a lot. As they say, a day without sunshine is like night." Okay. Crickets or vibrations were heard throughout the arena. Hart comes back with an atomic drop, spinning heel kick for a two count. Top rope elbow gets another two count. And... eventually, Hart takes the turnbuckle pad off the top rope, but then Owen is thrown chest first into the exposed turnbuckle, but he comes back with the dragon sleeper, but Steve Blackman uses his knees to break it. Hart hits a DDT, misses a drop kick, and then Blackman applies the sharpshooter,
because
that's going to get a pop here in Vancouver.
Well, no, the point was to... He was playing heel in this match.
Was he?
Absolutely, I would say so. The roles were completely reversed, and Blackman, even before applying the sharpshooter, was like looking at the crowd and motioning at the crowd like, "Fuck you guys, I'm gonna do this move."
Well, the finish though was totally booked as Owen here being the heel, where he just left the ring and intentionally gets counted out at 10:29.
Yeah,
I just thought this was lazy booking. That here we're going to Canada. What kind of reaction do you think Owen's going to get? Should we book it any differently, you think? Like, I'm not saying put him over, but understand what kind of setting this is going to be. And it's almost like, well, we're going to disregard how the audience feels here. I just thought this was such a nothing match for Owen here on this show in Canada. It was like, geez, was anyone clamoring for this even at the
crowd
time?
The crowd was so invested in this match. More, I would say, perhaps more than any other match for Owen here. And I was just disappointed at the lack of finish. I feel like, why not put Owen over? At least, you know, have him cheat the win. Come on. In a setting like this, I think it would have sent the crowd home really happy. And I think the fact that there was no finish and Owen didn't even win this match really soured the crowd for later on.
Vince is in the back looking for Mankind and comes up to the boiler room, which reads Mankind's office. And he goes in to talk to Mankind, and Mankind calls him Dad and says, "I just want to talk. I just want to talk." Now, am I crazy, or was this right out of the Wrestling with Shadows scene?
I don't remember.
Where we had Vince's office printed on the thing, and they show up, and they talk the day of the show.
Well, I don't know that specific... I don't know the specific dialogue of that scene.
We put it on into our documentary, that whole scene.
Yeah, but I don't know what the specific
I thought this was directly taken right out of it, and I don't think that's a far stretch
here.
Where they probably were talking about the finish. It was going to be a schmoz.
You could be right. Somebody can do a side-by-side comparison, and we'll see.
Brett, referring to Vince, he was like a father to me, and then Mankind calls him dad.
Wow.
I don't think I'm reading too much into this.
Hold on a second. Brett never called Vince dad.
He said many a time that he was so hurt by this because he considered Vince like a father to him.
But not in that scene.
No, he didn't. Not in that scene.
I really don't give him enough credit to parody Wrestling with Shadows.
The whole pay-per-view at the end of Survivor Series in this
that
was
their own finish, though. But this was a scene from a documentary that they didn't produce. Anyway.
Okay. Well, I'm just saying, this happened 1 month after Wrestling with Shadows came out. It came out like 3 weeks before this pay-per-view.
Okay, you know, you could be right. Could be right.
They announced the attendance here at GM Place, 20,042. And then we go to Al Snow, Scorpio, and Bob Holly against Gangrel, Edge, and Christian, the Brood.
And the Job Squad.
The Job Squad, who Lawler just referred to as the We Want a Job Squad. He's old school. He's not going to acknowledge what a job is.
What is a job? Yeah.
Cole sends out condolences to Ross for the passing of his mother, and he is under the weather this weekend.
He is. He also describes the members of the Brood and talks about Edge as he's the more quiet of the three.
It's amazing.
And he likes to stick to himself.
Yes. The loner. Who is this man?
He's the quiet one. Up until then, I don't know if he even
he never had talked at this point. Nope.
Yeah.
They note that Hardcore Holly, who is just Bob Holly here, he's sporting a new hairdo with a shaved head which is dyed blonde.
Mm-hmm.
And Lawler says, looks more like a hair don't than a hair do.
Yep.
We see a double underhook suplex by Holly to Christian, and a somersault leg drop by Scorpio off the second turnbuckle to Christian. Scorpio clearly knew, I probably have 40 seconds of in-ring time, and I'm going to make every second worth it for myself.
Yeah.
Lots of chance for head here. A number of signs for him. We see a wheelbarrow suplex by Snow, but Gangrel comes back with a DDT. The Brood then triple teams Al Snow in their corner. Edge makes the tag as he slides Snow across the ring. They work him over. There's a sit-out powerbomb by Snow to Edge, but the crowd was really dead for that.
Mm-hmm.
Scorpio ends up missing a pescado to the floor, and then Christian misses a top rope splash to Holly. Snow then knocks out Christian with head while Jimmy Corderas is distracted, and then Gangrel takes out Snow. Scorpio then hits a moonsault and ends it with a leg drop onto Christian.
Yep.
A finish in any other world for me, but Edge breaks up the cover. This maneuver was insane.
Mm-hmm.
Edge then gets off the back of Gangrel with a dive to the floor onto Snow and Holly, and it leads to Christian in the ring with Scorpio, hits what would later be the Unprettier for the win, 9 minutes and 9 seconds. Scorpio was just going crazy here, but the crowd really not into this.
No. I mean, all the guys in this match are good workers, and I thought the wrestling, it wasn't terrible. But people just didn't care about
anybody.
A crowd
brings a match down so much.
They just didn't care. They didn't identify with any of the people in this matchup.
They show Vince and Mankind and talking in the boiler room, but we don't hear anything. And then we go to the striptease match.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff Jarrett, accompanied by Deborah, taking on Goldust. And the stipulation here is that if Jarrett wins, Goldust must strip for the audience. And if Goldust wins, Deborah must strip for the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Deborah's entrance gets the biggest reaction. The build for this was Deborah and Goldust flashing each other on television. And Finkel announcing the stip got an even bigger reaction than Deborah coming out.
Yeah.
The crowd came to see tits on this show.
Absolutely. So much so that they started chanting Goldust. And I wasn't really sure if they were chanting because they loved Goldust or they simply wanted Goldust to win so they could see Deborah strip. I would think the latter.
That would be a safe assumption.
Yeah.
Very slow start. Goldust takes a back elbow and goes to the floor. Goldust reverses a high cross. Crowd was popping here for the near falls,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think it was their investment in the Goldust character advancing storyline-wise.
Yeah.
Goldust fights off a sleeper, but then Jarrett applies another one as the crowd gets behind Goldust, gets his arm up at two, suplexes Jarrett. Deborah then grabs the guitar. Tease is sending it in, but then Goldust hits the curtain call and has a visionary fall on Jarrett, and the crowd is just irate that Jack Doan is talking to Deborah and missing this pinfall, which could lead to a topless woman in their ring.
You're robbing us of our tits.
You fucker. Jarrett goes for this weak sunset flip, but Goldust just sits on top for another near fall. Crowd was just going nuts for these near falls. This is just ridiculous. Yeah. Sets Jarrett up for the Shattered Dreams, but then Deborah comes into the ring and grabs Goldust's ass. And Goldust goes ahead, hits the Shattered Dreams, and Jarrett goes to the floor. Deborah then comes in with a guitar. Goldust had to just be stupid here, ignoring her, to the point he even turned and then had to dart his head away to make sure I don't acknowledge that Deborah is holding a guitar above my head. And Deborah breaks the guitar onto Jarrett's head, and the referee is just oblivious to all of this. Jarrett comes in, hits the stroke onto Goldust, and he gets the pinfall at 8 minutes and 3 seconds, and the crowd just groans at this. We're going to see a penis.
The crowd was so hot for this match.
I thought the arena was going to clear here.
Yeah, they should put a woman's clothing on the line for every match.
You get a hot crowd.
Yeah.
But then Shawn Michaels comes down to the ring, and he was the commissioner at the time. And he sends Jarrett to the back, and he milks us because the crowd, they sense what's about to happen here. And Michael says, I've been reading the WWF rule book, and if you use an outside object, that is grounds for disqualification. And Jarrett is disqualified for the guitar being used, and Goldust wins and says that based on the stipulation, that means you have to strip, Deborah. Take your clothes off, and says, stop your grinning and drop your linen.
Yep.
Now, I thought at first this was to ensure there was no way this crowd would boo Michael. This was Michael's first time since Montreal, so you'd think these Canadians would want to crucify this man. And they booked him here in this segment where there was no way that they could boo him.
Which was strange to me because he was actually a heel.
Which I had no clue until I thought he was a babyface.
Oh, me too.
He acted like a babyface here, and then later in the show, he's a heel. I totally forget this.
Dude, in the very next segment, he didn't even go to the back. He just, anyway.
So, Deborah, channeling her inner TNA knockout when faced with this ultimatum of strip or leave, gets into it. And she's enjoying this striptease.
All women.
Instantly. She hears this music come on, and she's like a knockout washing a car.
They can't help themselves. Don't you know that?
They've got a body to show. And she starts playing up to the crowd. And Michaels takes out money and inserts it into her cleavage.
You're going to give me play-by-play of this striptease?
Yep. Then they show Jarrett watching backstage. And then she goes to take the bra off. But instead, the Blue Blazer runs in with his cape and covers Deborah. And Owen Hart, on the same show, gets the biggest pop and the biggest booze.
That's right.
All within a few matches of each other.
Absolutely.
And they take Deborah to the back, and there is no striptease.
There's no striptease. This poor crowd.
It was a... false advertising.
Maybe somebody called in.
As Ed the Sock would say, this was the master bait and switch.
Ha! Well, I gotta say, this totally worked for this audience at the time. And maybe it would still work today.
I don't know. It was what it was. The crowd was absolutely into this match.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So... they go backstage. Vince is leaving the boiler room after talking to Mankind, and he looks very happy. And I'm sure that happiness was about to dissipate if you watch this next match. The New Age Outlaws against Ken Shamrock and the Big Boss Man in a 60-minute Iron Man match for the tag titles.
Shawn Michaels accompanies the Big Boss Man and Ken Shamrock.
In the very next segment.
Yep.
I was so confused here. DX was banned from ringside. Michaels comes out, and he remains at ringside here in the corner of Bossman and Shamrock, and I was just so confused. Then the match began. Gunn almost gets... this was the fuck-up of all fuck-ups here. We saw Big Boss Man try to crotch Billy Gunn on the steel post, but he did the deal where he pulls his legs in to pull Boss Man into the post, but there was this like weird two-second delay on Boss Man's part, and he still had to sell it. Hilarity. Huh. Road Dogg comes in, does his shake, rattle, and roll. Shamrock attempts the ankle lock. Shamrock's gimmick at this time was he was just nuts. Mm-hmm. If someone would tell him something, he'd just go crazy.
Yeah.
He was an angry man. The heels worked on Road Dogg for approximately an hour. Michaels played heel against Gunn, where at one point he said, "Don't make me run. I'll fire your ass." Michaels was terrible here. Shamrock applies a standing guillotine to Road Dogg. Then he tags in Boss Man after like 3 minutes, and Boss Man applies the same standing guillotine. So then Boss Man gets bored of the maneuver, tags in Shamrock, who applies the same standing guillotine. Finally, Road Dogg makes a hot tag to Gunn after a year of selling. Gunn attempts to pin Shamrock, but Michaels pulls Timothy White out of the ring. Gunn goes for a vertical suplex on Shamrock, but Michaels pulls his leg out. But upon landing, Gunn reverses onto the top, shifts his weight, and pins Shamrock 17 minutes. This was one of the worst matches I've seen.
Yeah. 17.
Holy shit.
17 minutes, 15 minutes of which were used to build up to this hot tag, considering that they spent so much time building it up that the reaction that it received was not there at all.
I hated this match. It was so boring.
It was so boring. It was and the finish
made no sense.
No, the finish was fine. The finish.
Well, he had the leg pulled out where
it was supposed to be okay. I mean, yeah, Michaels trips Gunn as Gunn is suplexing. Who is it? The Boss Man.
Gunn was going to suplex Shamrock. Shamrock. And Shamrock lands on top and somehow flips over.
Gunn just was able to power out
of
it.
I was so happy this match was over.
It was fine, but the camera missed it.
True.
I thought it was a boring match, and the crowd only reacted for the pinfall, but other than that, everything seemed very mute. It was not worthwhile.
Horrendous match. Then we get a video of the Rock-Mankind feud with what led to The Rock turning heel and winning the title at the Survivor Series, joining the corporation. The background music for this video was something out of Waze Stereo. I encourage everyone to go watch it for this video package.
Okay.
This sounded totally like your music.
I didn't pay too much attention.
Vince, Shane, and Rock are in the back, and there's something about Mankind wants witnesses. I was lost on all this stuff.
Okay, no, I guess. Well, the story is that Mankind and Vince had worked out some type of deal, and Mankind was going to come out with his contract, and he wanted witnesses there so that he could sign with witnesses, even though there are 20,000 people all around them.
Mankind comes out. This was before his theme music you associate him with today, but after his original tune. So this was like this was up-tempo version.
Yeah, this was his original tune with a dance remix of his original
dance
tune.
The Mankind dance remix.
Yeah.
Didn't last very long. The Rock and Mankind, WWF title match. Before the match, they go over the contract where Foley will waive the stipulation. Okay, he's going to waive the stipulation that if Rock can't wrestle, then the title changes hands. When Rock is in the ring, ready to go.
Uh-huh. So does that mean there's no match if he were to sign this? Does that mean the show
No, it means he would have waived the stip that he would take the title if Rock couldn't wrestle. That's what they established earlier
in the
show.
But The Rock is about to wrestle.
I know.
So
I didn't understand it.
So are you telling me that if he signed this stip, then there would be no match? They would cancel the match and, like, Rock would forfeit. Anyway, it doesn't
No,
matter.
It didn't. It just... The only stipulation they mentioned was that if Rock cannot wrestle, Mankind gets the title. If Mankind's going to waive that stipulation, that means they're just having a straight-up match.
Well, why have the match at all? Why wouldn't Rock forfeit if there's nothing to lose?
Yeah, I guess so. This was so confusing.
Anyway, it doesn't matter.
This gives credence to Vince Russo, in fact, having booking power in the main event, which we were always told he didn't.
It really wasn't confusing.
I thought it was a bit confusing.
No, it was just stupid. And it didn't hook anybody. Nobody bought for a second that this match probably wasn't going to happen. It happened way too late in the build-up for this pay-per-view. It was just completely ineffective.
But you know what? Then the bell rung, and I said to myself, all that shit's out of the way. There's no way they can book this weird. This would be a great finish.
Yeah.
So all Mankind wants to waive this stip is for Vince to acknowledge that he never quit at the Survivor Series. And this is when Cole calls it the biggest double cross in WWF history. And Vince says, no, Rock heard you quit. And Mankind rips up the contract and the match starts. Let's just move on.
A huge waste of time.
So Vince and Shane are at ringside for this match. They fight on the floor to start. They run into the announce table. Vince goes on the microphone and tells the referee, if Mankind does anything questionable, he is to be disqualified. And the crowd is booing The Rock, who comes back, chokes Foley with a cable. Mankind gets yanked off the second turnbuckle onto the floor and is laid out. Rock comes onto commentary.
That was a huge bump.
Yeah.
From the second turnbuckle to the mat on the outside. And the guy just like...
And this was after King of the Ring, where he was banged up badly for a long time after that.
It was just such a crazy bump like that. It's just such a throwaway spot.
Yeah.
That's his style.
Back into the ring, Rock hits the corporate elbow. Complete babyface reaction to that move. I mean, that move was over at that point. Mankind kicks out of the corporate elbow. And then Mankind comes back with a low blow, and Vince wants to ring the bell for the low blow, but Foley pile drives the referee before he can call for the bell, and then he goes after the timekeeper. Rock then attacks Mankind from behind with a chair, and he hits a rock bottom to Mankind, but Mike Chioda is still out from the pile driver. Shane then goes to grab the title, goes to hit Mankind, who ducks and takes out Rock. And Mankind gets the visionary fall, but there's no ref. Tim White runs in, but Rock kicks out, and the fans popped huge for that kick out. They do a series of near falls that the crowd was into, and then Rock applies the mandible claw with Socko, and Tim White calls for the bell at 13 minutes and 34 seconds. Mankind celebrates. We're all under the impression Mankind has won the WWF title. But then Vince gets on the microphone and says, okay, fine. Mankind wins the match, but he didn't pin Rock, and Rock never gave up because he used the Socko claw, and therefore Mankind wins the match, but not the title. What?
Yeah.
Gotta give this match a fail.
This was just an incredibly overbooked matchup.
And very uncreative way to prolong this feud. Especially when you got the fuck finish at Survivor Series on top of that.
Yeah, yeah. No, I was not a fan of this. And if I had paid for this, I would probably feel quite chipped at the lack of resolution. It just seemed like they didn't want to give anything conclusive ending to any of their matches, any of their feuds in this pay-per-view. And afterwards,
Mankind got his heat back where he attacked Vince with the claw. Then a series of chair shots are delivered to Mankind from Shane. Mankind attacks Shane. He fights off Patterson and Briscoe, and he's finally taken down by Shamrock, Bossman, and The Rock, who beat down on Mankind. So the feud continues, but for a pay-per-view, horrible, I thought. Just horrible booking for this.
Yeah.
Video preview for the main event. This preview was great. We had Austin give the middle finger to The Undertaker, and they put laser sound effects into this package when he delivered the middle finger.
Yeah.
They showed him blacking out at a house show in San Jose, stemming from the angle. This had everything that the Attitude Era was great for. We had The Undertaker attempt to embalm Steve Austin in a funeral home. Mm-hmm. He was going to embalm him. So what did Austin do for revenge? He took Paul Bearer hostage and shoved him down a sewer.
Oh,
that'll show him.
That makes sense. You embalm me, I'm going to shove your dad down the sewer.
So Undertaker said, oh yeah? I'll sacrifice you on a cross like Jesus, bitch. Wow, this was WWF at their finest.
Yeah.
And at the core of this, there was at least a stipulation. And that was if Austin won this Buried Alive match, he would get a spot in the Royal Rumble. And I believe if he lost, was his career done? Is that what they said?
I don't remember.
The Rumble stip was legit. I don't know about the career thing. But The match begins with Undertaker and Austin. Paul Bearer is in the corner of Undertaker, so he got out of the sewer. And Michael Cole starts this match by saying, not just his career, but his life is on the line in regards to Steve Austin.
Well, yeah.
You could die.
You're buried alive in the middle of a hockey arena. You're not getting back out.
So they fight in the aisle by the gravesite. Then they fight to the ring. Austin takes a back body drop at one point onto the floor by the announce table. And they fight back down the aisle. Austin throws a barricade at the Undertaker. And then they fight into the grave, which the crowd, for whatever reason, going into a hole of dirt meant pop. They were excited for this. Cole says that the crowd got dead in the middle of this. So Cole explains it by saying, fans don't know what to expect because they've never seen anything like this before. Which, according to our archives at fightnetwork.com/podcast, you can find out, in fact, there was a prior Buried Alive match.
Weren't there many before this?
I don't know how many there were. There was at least one before this. Yeah. Maybe more. They go back to the gravesite. Undertaker pulls out a can of gas that was just sitting around, just in case. And Austin,
gas cans at cemeteries.
Yeah, you never know when you might need some gasoline in an arena full of 20,000 fans. So Austin hits Taker in the head with the gas can, and they continue to fight, and Undertaker ends up taking a plastic cup of pop to the head from a fan.
Did he?
Did you not see this?
No, I didn't see that.
Some fan from, like, in the arena threw a plastic pop can, and it hit Undertaker in the back of the head, and the crowd popped for this, and wow. Taker looked pissed. Yeah. And I don't blame him. It's the highlight of the match for me. Austin then attacks with shots to the head, stuns Taker, who falls into the grave from the stunner. And then Austin chases Paul Bearer to the back. Taker eventually rises up from the grave, and then he climbs beside the gravesite with a shovel and hides, waiting for Austin to come. Then the what do we do for a living, dude? Oh, this is nuts.
No. Yeah.
The gravesite explodes with pyro as Kane comes out. And they fight. Kane and Undertaker fight by the grave. Taker goes for a tombstone, but he's distracted as Kane reverses the tombstone, feel the irony, and tombstones Taker into the grave. And Austin comes out with, like, a bulldozer.
Oh, boy.
I'm not going to complain about anything in 2011 watching this. Uh-huh. This was the peak, dude. Oh, he fills... This was, like, awkward as fuck, because this bulldozer was not the fastest thing in the world.
No.
Nor do I want a guy on live pay-per-view freaking out about the bulldozer and rushing this, because God knows what could have happened here. But he eventually fills the grave with dirt. Austin was getting impatient by this guy taking so long that he just started shoveling dirt in. Then he drinks a beer. He's declared the winner, just over 21 minutes, so he qualifies for the Rumble. He's covered in dirt, and who knows what diseases he might have contracted here. Maybe some staph. And goes into the ring to celebrate, and that's how the pay-per-view ends. And The Undertaker and Austin got some time off after this match, where Austin was off TV for the next 3 weeks, and Taker would be off for about a month after this.
Well, there you go.
What a show.
What a show.
I give this 2 out of 10. And I think that's being generous, dude. I hated this show.
Yeah, I give it a 1.5 out of 10. Just nothing very special for me. This was not a very good show. The crowd was hot at parts.
Very small. We had Owen's entrance.
Yep.
We had bits of the Rock match.
And the main event as well.
Yeah, and fuck, it's such a goofy, like, gimmick match. The Buried Alive match.
As goofy as it is.
The guys were trying, yeah. You know what I mean?
As goofy as it is, like, and as much as we might look down on, like, the striptease match and whatnot, like, the crowd at this time really reacted to, I guess, trailblazing ideas such as these. But for much of this show, the crowd really brought it down. They were dead for almost everything else.
Yeah, and not to just blame the whole crowd, though. It's not like the stuff in the ring was really, livening up a dead crowd either. Mm-hmm. It was not a great show at all. And this is a very skippable event.
There were no great matches and a bunch of very lame finishes with inconclusive endings. So there you go.
Rock bottom. 1.5 out of 10 by Wei and 2 out of 10 by me. But let's see what you, the listeners, had to say about rock bottom. 5 people watched it. Can't blame them.
Well, 3 other people liked it, so maybe they...
No, they liked my post.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if they liked the show.
Well, yes, we have 5 comments, and it's one of those shows that it's not the easiest to go and find, so I don't blame them.
No, this is a very difficult show to find.
Yeah.
We had to rely on the VHS copy.
As well as the alternative copy.
Oh, yeah, you had to hunt for one.
Yes. That's right.
Why don't you kick us off, Wei?
From Altamush Gazdar, this show was really special to me because it was my first ever live show. I was 16, had just moved to Canada, and was a huge mark for The Rock. Considering most of my family despises wrestling, and the fact that I didn't have a clue about getting around in a new city, I had to beg to be allowed to go downtown for the show. The things that stand out for me are The Rock's taped promo at the now-defunct Planet Hollywood Vancouver, and the ridiculously loud pop that Austin got. I was sitting right above the grave, and had one of the best views of all the action in the main event. The rest of the card, not so much. That is just such a funny sentence. I went to a show.
I was sitting right above the grave.
Right above the grave. Have you ever been to a Planet Hollywood?
No, I never went.
Me neither. I didn't get the appeal.
They were big money losers.
Yep.
Josh Parrish, I was enjoying following the WWF in the 90s. Hell, my whole life since 1984. My biggest mistake was trying to follow WCW along with Raw, SmackDown, and Thunder. It just became overkill and just confusion to the max with me and my love of pro wrestling. What that has to do with rock bottom, I have no clue. But thanks, Josh.
Yeah, thanks, Josh. Kevin Nagel. I was really into the Attitude Era during this time. The Rock heel turn at Survivor Series the previous month was unexpected, but really set the forthcoming feud with Austin nicely. It's funny how B pay-per-views during this time were as important as the A shows, compared to today where you can skip any of the lower-tier shows and not miss much. I didn't really find that to be the case with this show. I thought this
didn't feel like a big show at all.
It was totally missable. There were a lot of non-finishes, and I don't know.
But I can see, you know, they were... an upgrade from when they had the In Your Houses, where those were just complete filler, well, where you wouldn't even get the main event guys sometimes on shows.
Well,
so.
Those are cheaper, too, and probably shorter.
We go to James Starkey. This was one of the pay-per-views I remember owning on VHS, and I look back on it with fond memories. But in reality, the only memorable things were The Rock and Mankind's promos and the two main events, which were, although messy, entertaining. The video packages before the match were fantastic and took me right back to my childhood. I didn't watch Raw at this time. I just bought the pay-per-views when they were released on home video, so it was sometimes hard to keep up with the storylines. But The Rock's turn and his feud with Mankind was recapped excellently. It really made the match seem so important. In the video package, there's a clip where Vince has The Rock face Mark Henry, and when he wins, it's made out to be such a huge deal with the aid of JR's brilliant selling. I remember being a young kid and getting so psyched up for that. I wonder if kids feel that way now. I hope so.
I hope so, too.
I always feel you can't be objective about things from your childhood, because I think there's a certain nostalgia to them. And I think this pay-per-view is a perfect example.
Sure.
If this show happened today, people would shit on this show.
Yeah, maybe. But we're also at different places in our lives when we're watching these shows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's different for everyone. Eddie Miguez, as a high schooler deeply entrenched in the Russo era, I really, 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 really thought Deborah was getting naked in accordance to the stipulations which said she had to. Second memory, this was by far the most over a crowd was for Goldust. Every punch he threw against Jarrett was like a 1987 Hulk Hogan punch. The crowd was dying for him to win because of the stipulation. I can't say I want to watch this show ever again, to be honest.
Well, he didn't get what he paid for.
That's right. But at the time, I mean, I could see him buying into it because they did have nudity. Maybe not yet, though, actually.
They had done a UK pay-per-view where Jacqueline got topless.
Before this?
It was before this,
okay.
I believe it was earlier in 98.
Yeah.
So they had to at least tease it. Maybe the UK, they thought it would be more acceptable than in the US or in Canada. I mean, you're also, like, promote. This was a big deal when Stacey Carter ripped her top off, was that you're showing nudity at an event where you're allowing children into.
Yep.
I mean, there's a lot of laws here that are technically being broken here.
I guess so, yeah. Well, I mean, there was that. There's also Mae Young.
Yes, I guess.
Hey, but if wardrobe malfunction, you can claim that.
Yes.
They weren't supposed to. Nobody
was. Well, that's what they did say with Stacey Carter. They said she did that on her own, which I don't think anyone bought.
Yeah.
That was rock bottom for the WWF in December of 98, and that's going to wrap us up here, everyone. Thanks a lot for your feedback. You can always go to reviewaway.com, and this is our final review of 2011. And next week, Way, we are going to kick off 2012 with the very first Raw from 1999. And this was an infamous show, January 4th of 99. It was the same night as the Finger Poke of Doom with Nash and Hogan, which we reviewed a couple of years back. But meanwhile, on the other channel, Mankind was winning his first WWF title on a taped show. Mm-hmm. It's actually taped at the end of December. But we're going to review that Raw and go back to the height of the Attitude Era with a taped show going against Nitro from the Georgia Dome and see what the WWF countered Nitro with.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
Spoiler alert, Mankind wins the WWF title.
That'll put asses in seats.
That's going to put earbuds in ears.
There you go.
But Way, as we go off with our final tune of 2011, only you can choose an appropriate song.
Oh, and me. Okay. Oh, boy. Tough choice. I think I will have to go with... Wait for it.
Oh, wow. This. I can hear it.
There we go. This is the song.
Oh, nice choice.
Studios, what's up? Who this is? Who this is?
Look at this rapper, so I'll tell you. Who is this?
Oh, this P.
P?
Yeah, this P.
P?
Yeah.
P, let me hear you say, This ain't no motherfucking P.
Beautiful.
Respect is a step quick. Cause I got a vicious right hand, but you know what? My left is quick. Two, you just have.